Good evening. My guest tonight's next trip is to the Antarctic, alone. Now, this despite being totally blind and partially deaf. That ought, even by this programme's standards, to be extraordinary until you learn that Tony Giles has travelled in well over 50 countries, in most of them alone, and on every continent, except, so far, Antarctica. He's written a book about those experiences called Seeing the World My Way. Tony, first of all, what's the lure of Antarctica? Is it just that it's the only unvisited continent left here?
It's not the only reason. It's the challenge of getting there, the unique, different experience that continent holds, the weather, the isolation, and nature in sound and smell.
And how much is this like your other trips? Because my view, perhaps a rather untutored view of Antarctica, is, you know, it's just a lot of ice, really. So what's somebody like you going to get out of that?
Well, to start with, getting there, the only way is by boat or plane. So I've got 2 or 3 days sailing, mingled with other passengers. A lot of lectures and information about the nature out there. But getting there, once getting on the ice, walking around, smelling the seals and the penguin poo, feeling the minus temperatures on my face and body, and just the experience of the whole environment.
And presumably going alone for you means travelling alone, but presumably there will be the kind of help that anybody going to Antarctica would get.
Yeah, I mean, you can't just get in a rowing boat, unfortunately, and sail out there. You have to do an organised cruise.
OK,
yeah.
Well, we'll go into more detail a little later. And in tonight's programme, that's what we're going to be doing, talking about solo travel for people with little or no sight, the hows and the whys. Also with us is Kirsten Hearn, a regular for this programme. And I think it's fair to say, Kirsten, isn't it, you're a keen but cautious traveller who'd always quite fancied the idea of travelling on your own, but only just recently plucked up the courage to do it.
Yes, that's right. I'm a deeply curious person with great fantasies to wander across the globe to all different kinds of places. And I really enjoy doing it by myself. I could go with others. But there's something about lone travel which brings a different experience. And so I'm really interested in continuing to do that.
And you did do your first lone trip earlier last year.
I did London to Spain and back again by train last year. I'd done some other ones before. Certainly as a youth, I did a lot of travelling across Europe, but then you're foolish when you're 19, aren't you? And I'm not that anymore.
Did you do that alone?
Yes.
You did?
Oh, yes. I have a history of travelling alone. It's just I stopped doing it for 30 years because I got a bit cowardly. And I suppose maybe it's, you know, the age I am. I'm going back to my teenage years. I want to be 19 again. All those years ago, I sauntered across Europe with great aplomb and, you know, things happen like getting arrested. Just for being me, I think, actually. But I survived it all. Now, for many, many years, I just thought, oh, no, I need to go with somebody. Or, oh, no, I have to take a short trip. And last year, I thought, I'm going to go and do it.
OK, well, I know you have some questions you'd like to put to Tony about the do's and the don'ts, and I'll give you a chance to do that in a moment. But first, Tony, how did you embark on this career of travelling alone? What was its starting point?
I don't mean it was any kind of starting point. I didn't wake up one day and think, all right, I'm going to go travelling. It was a natural progression. I went to a boarding school for the blind at Coventry.
Exhall Grange. Yeah.
Yeah, I went to Exhall Grange for 6 years. Got all those skills necessary just to lead a fairly normal life. I wanted to be independent, and my mobility officer didn't give me much of a choice. And once I was travelling home to see my parents at weekends by train and bus, it was a natural progression. I got to go to America with a school at 16. It was really through studying at university, American Studies course when I was 19, 20. I got sent to South Carolina for 4 months. And through that opportunity, I decided to go to New Orleans by myself because all my friends went to Florida.
So you went on your own because there was no one else to go with initially. It wasn't a philosophical decision.
No, it was really I was at a stage of my life where I was drinking and partying and all my friends weren't going to really let me do that. And I thought, right, they're not going to let me do what I want. I'll do it myself. And I decided, yeah, that was it.
So, and then you developed a taste for it.
Yeah, and it just escalated.
But you've done some subsequently far more daring things than that. You were describing their relatively urban circumstances, but you've backpacked, haven't you? You've been to Australia, you've travelled in Asia.
Yeah, and Africa and South America.
So what's different about that?
Well, obviously, the environment's much more rugged, much more dangerous in some ways. You're on your own. You're relying on the elements. You're relying on local people to help you.
Off-road, quite a lot of the time?
Off-road, camping, hiking.
You see, that's what startles me. I'm sure Kirsten will carry on this in a minute. But, you know, I'm all right as long as I've got a wall to tap and a lamppost to walk into. It's the idea of you going off-road, across country, camping in fields, that is where I part company with you.
I don't have a problem with the camping in fields because there's things you can do to make sure you find your way back to your tent. But there is that whole issue of not having anything particularly to follow to actually yomp across a field involves directional kind of aiming. And I think as and somebody who's also partially deaf, Tony, I don't know if that affects your balance and your direction. I mean, how did you get across fields by yourself?
Certainly when I got high winds and strong winds, that directional sense goes out of the way. A lot of it's common sense. I did it when I was younger with people, and it's the having the confidence to do that.
Well, let's do the tent in the field thing. You pitched your tent, fair enough. I'd have had trouble doing that, but you did that. Let's accept that you can pitch a tent. Yes. You went out for the night out, then you got back, then you found the tent. I'd have had trouble finding the field.
Yeah. Like I say, use my common sense. So I needed a landmark I could feel with my feet and my stick. So I'd have some idea that I was close to where the tent was. So I pitched it in a field and I looked around the area with my stick and I found a small gravel path. So, right, that's pretty close enough.
So you had a landmark?
Yeah.
What's the most scared you've been?
I always get scared before every trip, which is a good experience, which knows that, the day I stop getting scared before every trip, I'll start travelling, I think. Mm. I think the most scared was actually as I got to New Orleans, ordered it, booked a flight, booked a hostel, it's pretty straightforward. And I got to the hostel, I took a taxi from the airport, and I walked outside the steps, I got directions to the nearest tram stop, and I suddenly froze, and I thought, I'm in a city by myself, I'd never been before, and totally blind, I can't do this. And I just froze and panicked for about a minute. Now I took a deep breath, said to myself, this is what you want, this is the challenge.
So that was quite early on, yeah. It was in that first trip.
And I turned left, walked down the street, and never looked back.
Because it is very psychological. It's interesting that Kirsten was making that point, that in many ways, whatever level of travelling, whether you're going to the shops or going to New Zealand or somewhere even more remote, the hardest two things are stepping out of your front door and getting to precisely where you want to go as opposed to within 30 yards of it.
That's right.
Kirsten, wouldn't you say that's...
Yes, and I am a bit of a control freak, so I do several things before... Yes, surely not. Before I went on this trip to Spain and other ones I've been on, I made sure, obviously, that I knew where all my tickets were, I knew which part of the journey I was doing, wherever. In certain parts of the place, particularly in Paris, where French people's attitudes to disabled people is that we're very independent, therefore there's no support, I actually arranged for a friend of a friend of a friend to actually meet me because I just knew there wouldn't be any assistance. But the thing that I did more importantly was actually the whole mental preparation was I would think about, well, what am I going to do if I get off the train, there isn't anybody else to help me? What will I do if I miss my stop on the subway? And I thought about all those things and thought about what would the strategies be for those. And just having done that made me feel a bit more relaxed. And what was really interesting, I think, and I don't know if you found this, Tony, that if you felt okay about yourself, your interactions with other people usually went more smooth than if you were feeling a bit uptight about something.
Yeah, certainly. The more relaxed you are, the more able you are to open up with people and connect with people. Mm. And that comes across. That comes across in your mannerisms and your voice and your actions. Mm.
I know, Kirsten, one of the things you're interested in is this whole business of, because you're asking for help, sometimes you need to, that opens you up to good things, but it can open you up to bad things as well.
Yes, that does seem to be a bit of a trade-off. And what's very interesting, actually, in the country where you can understand the language, there's a slightly different trade-off going on. In the UK, when people ask me if I've asked for assistance, you know, how long have you been like that, another slightly irritating question which have no relevance whatsoever, I have to balance the issue of I need to get across this road, so therefore my response has to be enough to satisfy them, but not in any way abrupt or difficult that they might then abandon me in the middle of said road. Now, in another country where English is not the language being spoken around you, and I'm not very proficient in either Spanish or French, I found that actually people, if they asked it, it was quite difficult to answer in any other than a very straightforward way because I didn't have the language. But there was this thing going on wherever I was, whether in the UK or anywhere else, actually, that people would ask me eventually at some point. The ladies in the sleeping compartment would ask me about my impairment, by which time we'd had half an hour conversation, so I actually felt okay about it.
Right. What about that, Tony? Because I get the impression that you're one of those people, you do now, certainly, maybe not the very first time, but now you bowl off, you have confidence in your ability to cope, but you do ask for help when you need it. And I wonder if that, to some extent, there's a gender element involved here, if it's easier for males to some extent.
I think it can be and it can't be. I think women can have it easier than men sometimes. It depends how you approach it, how you look and the word confidence. I believe if you give a little, you'll get a little. Especially when I was travelling in New Zealand, people were prepared to take me down a pub, throw me off bridges on bungee jumps. Because I was positive, I was willing to have a go at everything. But I was also willing to accept I needed help. And let's face it, anyone who's travelling, whether it's around England or to a foreign country, we all need help.
For me, it's about being really clear about what I need. And, you know, when you're in a country where you're not, you don't have the common language, you don't speak their language, you have to be really very clear and very simple about it. And a lot of gestures go. But I decided, actually, that actually what I will do is simply ask. And when I was thinking about, it's no point in saying to people who don't speak your language, where is the, because they'll point. Or they might give you five sentences in something incomprehensible. The best thing to do is to say, can you take me to the toilet or wherever it is one needs to, or the bus or that sort of stuff. So I certainly found that actually interacting...
And that's better than doing it in three stages, where first of all you try to indicate where it is and then you try... Yeah, be direct,
life's
is what
too
you're
short.
Saying.
Yeah, because the thing is that in the UK or in a place where you're sharing a language, there's a nuance of persuasion. And it's very interesting, and in the UK, because people are a bit reticent, well, you know, in England, actually London, people are a bit reticent, whereas I actually find in Wales, when I'd be wandering around there, or Scotland, they're a bit more helpful, because probably there's less people, so they probably have to be, really. And I think that if people are reticent, you have to do more persuading.
Do you ever feel you ask too much of people?
Yes, sometimes, but I think it balances out. I think they get a different experience from meeting me and travelling with me and seeing how I operate, or not, as sometimes. And it's an exchange, it's a give and take. We're all out there to help each other, I believe. Sometimes things do go wrong, you do get mugged, and but that's part
of
travelling.
Have you been mugged?
I've been mugged.
You've had things stolen?
I've had things stolen, but it's part of travelling. I know I'm blind and deaf and I'm more vulnerable potentially than others, but you know, I could stay home and have a lovely, wonderful life, but I wouldn't get what I get out of it.
There is one question I must ask you at this point, because people will be wondering, because you travel a lot, which must mean that, yeah, I mean, how do you afford it?
I'm very lucky, or maybe unlucky, but my dad died about 15, 16 years ago and left me a legacy. I get a monthly pension, which allows me to travel on a very cheap budget. I write my blog on my website, tonythetraveller.com.
Have you ever been just plain lost? Because I think that's people's fear, however rational or irrational it is. Have you ever just thought that, not knowing where you are, and there has not been anybody around to ask?
I think probably have been times when I felt that way and kind of thought, all right, what do I do now, and just give up. But you keep going, you keep saying to yourself, there's got to be someone somewhere eventually, and this path has got to lead somewhere eventually.
I have to just say, that reminds me, nothing as adventurous as you, but I think the first time somebody showed real confidence with me was at university. I was with a mate of mine walking around a field having a bitter argument about something, and he could see and I couldn't. And in the end, he said, well, if that's the way you feel, and he just left. And there I was, in the middle of a field. Now, whether you're in Canterbury or England or Canterbury, New Zealand, fields are relatively featureless. And I didn't know where I was. Like you, in the end, when I'd stopped being angry and then started to feel rather admiring that he'd done it, I realised that, of course, if you go round a field literally from right round the edge, sooner or later, there's got to be a way out of it. So it's that's where you apply your logic, I guess.
That is, of course, if you can actually find the edge of the field.
Oh, I know, because they can be wide, you could be going at an angle, therefore you can be missing the edge. So, Kirsten, this was partly, the idea was for you to fire things at anything else that you think you'd like, because I take it you have other trips planned. Oh, now you've got your confidence back.
Yes. Tony, I want to know, what do you say to people when they ask you about your impairment? What is it different in different countries?
In Europe and in Britain, typical Britain, people don't come out and straight say, what can you see, what can't you? People are much more reserved.
Yeah.
You go to somewhere like America, Australia, where people are more direct, they'll ask you. I'll break the ice, I'll make jokes. I'm very confident about my discipline. I want people to know I'm blind, this is what I can't see, this is what I can, and this is what I can do, and this is what I can't.
I mean, there is another issue here about when you're getting the help of strangers, which is you might eventually want to get rid of them. I mean, some people become, if you like, you suddenly realise that they've fastened onto you rather than the other way around. Do you have a technique for that, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, people sometimes want to be over-helpful, you know, and think you can't do it and look after you. I think it's just got to be courteous, but also direct without being too aggressive, really. I just tend to say, you know, I'm all right, mate, thanks. Cheers.
You see, you sound very relaxed about all this. You take this in your stride. You clearly don't lie awake worrying about this stuff.
You can't lie awake worrying, mate. You know, life's too short.
Kirsten, I mean, is that something... I mean, because I sense that you're a bit more concerned about what could be your privacy being invaded. Is this something you...
Yes. It's very interesting, actually, because I was trying to avoid a drunk on the way here, actually, because I just knew that he was offering me lots of help and I just knew it would be difficult and that probably wouldn't be very helpful because he really couldn't put one foot in front of the other, which is very unfortunate. But in terms of, like, trying to get rid of people who are a bit limpet, like, it can be very difficult. Mm. And sometimes I have this debate with myself, which says... OK, so how much does this matter that this person is going to be with me for the X amount of time?
For the rest of your life.
You know, for the next 5 minutes, you know, can I cope with this? And if I, and I'm quite pragmatic, if I can, I just put up with it. But of course, sometimes I get rid of them and the storm off somewhere, you know, it gets fast away as I possibly can, walk into the nearest lamppost. And it's terribly humiliating, actually, because, you know, there you are, go, I can manage perfectly well, and you fall over. So it can be very difficult, but I am, like Tony, I say, thank you very much. I've had enough. And I do broken record if they're not listening. I'm all right now. Thank you very much. I'm all right now. Thank you. And I keep going until they hear it.
Until you bore them to death.
Exactly.
Sorry, Tony.
And I think the other thing is, it's, you know, sometimes, when certainly when you're in foreign countries, you've got people who are hanging on you to try and take advantage of you.
Yeah, lift your purse, yeah. Mm.
Mm. You know, it's quite a judgment to work out who is safe and who isn't. And you only learn that through travelling more. And so, you know, you try and say, yeah, I'm going off the other way now. Or sometimes it's just to linger longer in a shop or just sit down. And eventually they'll just go away.
Imagine, Tony, this... the way you travel could be quite addictive. Do you never just want to travel in a kind of completely relaxed way with other people, partly to enjoy their company and partly so you don't have to worry about where you've left your tent or where the next bus is?
Yeah, but you do that anyway, because you say I'm travelling alone, but in a way I'm not, because you're always meeting people, or nearly always meeting people. There's very few countries where you're completely alone. Zimbabwe may be one exception. But you're always meeting backpackers and you meet people and you want to join up with them and they're doing something or they're going the same direction.
So it's not that you're ever lonely, it's just that you want to be travelling on your own as far as... In other words, it's always you who makes the decision when you move on.
Yeah, it's the independence and the flexibility.
OK, but can I just ask you something around that, you know, meeting up with other people? How do you gauge the not being too much of a nuisance yourself a bit? Because it may be a state of mind that I have at times, be a little conscious that maybe they don't want me, whatever it is, actually, and thinking I don't really want to kind of, like, interfere with somebody else's other plans, yes, especially if they make you feel like you've done so. How do you notice that and how do you deal with it?
I think it's difficult. You try and listen to people's voices. I think you can tell if someone really doesn't want you by what they kind of say. But you just try and ask people in a quiet moment, you know, is it all right? Are you really sure? You can tell pretty quickly if someone doesn't want you.
I mean, do you, to some extent, take the attitude... I mean, isn't it tempting occasionally, if you actually need somebody for a little bit longer, just to ignore all the signs and get them, make sure they get you to where you want to go?
Yes.
Great piece of honesty. Thank you. Well, that seems a pretty good place to stop, and it's all we've got time for anyway. But, Tony, we wish you well on your trip to Antarctica, and Kirsten, you're going to write a column for a future programme about your Spanish trip. And, Tony, maybe we'll see you again on your return too. If you've got any comments, you can contact us on 0800 044 044, and there'll be a podcast of today's programme available from tomorrow. From me, Peter White, producer Cheryl Gabriel, Kirsten Hearn, Tony Giles, good night.